Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome along. It's the Full Throttle Podcast, the motorcycle racing podcast from Eurosport. It's Monday, the 11th of October, 2021, and that really can mean only one thing. It's a doubleheader again of the Bennetts British Superbike finale at Brands Hatch, the final three races, and also three critical races over in Argentina for the Motul FIM Superbike World Championship. Across those two championships, we have a total of 12 support categories. Some of them have already finished this year or been decided. Others are still very much alive. Others on the brink of being decided. And between us here today, Tristan Finocchiaro, Eurosport commentary colleague, and me, Greg Haynes, we're going to touch on every single one of those 12 categories. Tristan, first of all, it just makes you realise how much bike racing and how many riders and how many overtakes and how many laps we've had this year, doesn't it? 12 different categories.
Yeah, absolutely. And like it very much feels like the end now, doesn't it? Only one round left of BSB and possibly a couple. We're waiting for that to be confirmed for World Superbike. But still plenty of racing to do because there's plenty of titles to be decided and plenty of action to come as well. Even in a couple of classes where titles have been decided, a little bit more racing to go as well. So first weekend off for us for a while, but it's nice for us now. We can reflect on everything that's happened and have a quick breather before it all goes again next week.
Right, I've worked this out. 1 hour divided by 12 categories is 5 minutes per category. So we'll probably give a bit more to some of them and a bit less to others. But let's kick it straight off. Let's stay close to home, shall we? First of all, BSB. Right, showdown time. And I have to say, I was doing a prediction for MCN this week, and it's probably the hardest prediction I've ever had to do. I really want to say Jason O'Halloran's going to win it, and that's who I've gone for the MCN paper this week.
Okay.
But the other side of my head is saying, no, it's going to be Taran McKenzie. In a way, I'd feel so bad for Yamaha if they didn't win it after the season they've got. But then again, Eden's in there, Bridewell's in there, Buchan and Hickman mathematically are still in there. It's the showdown, I guess, isn't it? That's what it's designed to do.
Yeah, like you say, that's what it's designed to do, and that's what it will do. You're going for Jason, to be honest. I think I would go for Taran if I had to make the decision.
Yeah, I was going to go for Taran, and I changed my mind. I thought, oh no, I can't not go for Jason after the year he's had.
I think Jason obviously deserves it, and I think he'll be a little bit disheartened by the fact, by the showdown, by the way it all works. Because at one point he had a really, really big leader, up to 120 points, something like that at one point. Yeah. So he would have been, you know, really, really sort of thinking that he had that in the bag. But this is what the showdown's designed for. It makes it exciting, gets spectators through the gates at Brands Hatch at the final round. And it always makes that final round really, really interesting. I mean, we think back to the finish between Tommy Hill and John Hopkins, and that's exactly the type of racing we want. And hopefully we'll get another championship decided by and that sort of amount of time on track.
Yeah, and of course, that was 10 years ago this year, wasn't it? That was 2011, and here we are in 21. That's gone quick, hasn't it? But ironically, it was a Yamaha rider's dominance in 2009, Leon Kamier, that triggered the showdown for the next year. So how ironic would it be if Jason O'Halloran doesn't end up winning it? Okay, so looking at the situation, Brooks and Irwin, Glenn Irwin are obviously out of it. Hickman and Buchan really need to just win three races and hope for other things to happen. Otherwise, it's not going to happen, is it? Let's be realistic. But 21 points between the top four. McKenzie's got O'Halloran 10 behind, Eden 15 behind, and Bridewell 21 behind. And really, it could go any one of those four ways, couldn't it? Because you just don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be cold. It might be wet. Who knows what's going to happen?
That's the thing as well. That last round is always cold, wet,
yes.
Miserable.
Quite dark as well by that last race.
Yeah, and can quite literally go any way. But I mean, like I said earlier, I'd put my money on Tarrant. He goes well around Brands Hatch. I'm pretty sure, yeah, he picked up a win there earlier in the season and a couple of podiums. Has always gone well around there. And he's on good form at the moment. It always seems to come good when the pressure's on. So it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out. It can go anyway, of course, because Brands can catch people out when it's a bit mixed conditions or bad conditions. There's a couple of corners really tricky to navigate in the wet. I'm thinking Graham Hill in particular. Always seek some sort of action or crashes or big moments there. So, but I mean, it could be dry all weekend. We don't know.
No, we don't. And just looking at the standings with 21 points available for... 25 points available for a win. Any one of those top four can be in any one of those positions, couldn't they, even after the first race? So Tasmac, Jason, Iden and Bridewell, I would not want to put money on that. I really would not want to put money on that. Although I would feel sorry for McCam Yamaha because they've been the team to beat, haven't they? Let's be honest. If they didn't win this title. But then again, this is what people say, isn't it?
They have the Constructors' Championship, I think, though, haven't they?
Yeah. So at least they got some. Yeah, but they want the riders, don't they? Let's be honest. Yeah, yeah. They desperately want it. I'd feel sorry for Steve Rogers and all the guys there if they didn't get that. But that's the way the showdown works. So go on, who would you go for, Taz? If you had to put money on it. Okay.
Yeah, I think I'd put my money on Taz personally.
All right, well, I'm going to stick with Jason. I was going to write Taz the other day, and then at the last moment I thought, no, I can't bring myself to do it. I'd need to put Jason just because of the season he's had. Having said that, it's been a bit of an ordinary showdown with two non-scores from the six races so far. Okay, that's British Superbike. Let's move on. Let's pick another one. Let's do one of the BSB support categories. Let's go for, what do you fancy going for?
Which one's the most closely to be decided?
Ooh, that is a very good question.
Super Sport's looking quite open, isn't it? And it's the natural sort of step down.
Yeah, let's go for British Super Sport. Okay, so Jack Kennedy then has the advantage. It's a 34-point lead over Ben Curry, 54 back to Lee Johnston, which means Lee is out of it because there's only 50 points available. So realistically, very much realistically, it's Jack Kennedy's to lose. But we've seen before, haven't we, as we just said, things can change at Brands Hatch. Although what is interesting is that Ben Curry is actually yet to win a race this year. He's had 7 second places and 2/3. Just goes to show how consistency pays off, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, I mean, Brad Peary's been on fire all year on that Yamaha R6, and it's been, he's picked up, I think, he's picked up 6 wins this season, and he's looked really, really strong. But it's just a couple of DNFs, a couple of crashes that weren't sort of, obviously weren't needed, but was just sort of a little bit too much, and a couple of unlucky DNFs as well. And unfortunately, he's down in fourth in the championship.
Hey, that's unbelievable, really, isn't it? Because it feels like he should be on the top of it.
Yeah, he's had as many wins as Jack Kennedy. Just a few more DNFs. So Jack's had a few himself, in all fairness. But yeah, that's really been Bradley's downfall. And I think, you know, to be honest, in terms of on-track talent, I think it's between Jack and Brad, but in terms of the championship, it's between Jack and Ben Curry. But Ben Curry's come in quite strong in the last few rounds, has picked up, like I say, hasn't won a race this year, strangely, but it's picked up a lot of second places, and is always there or thereabouts. And it's consistency that wins the championship. We saw even in GP last year, Mia won the championship with only at one point only one win.
Well, Brad Peary and Lee Johnston, if I'm not mistaken, had a collision, didn't they, coming out of the Melbourne Loop the other day, and they both went down, so they obviously lost more points there. I like Brad Peary, though, do you? He's a great character. Jack Burnicle's always said, Greg, sometimes Jack sat in the commentary box and he's finishing Supersport and I'm getting ready to come in. And you'll say, oh, Greg, Brad Peary's a bit like you, isn't he? He's a bit like a nice version of you, Jack said once. So thanks very much, Jack. But I do like him. He's a great character and he rides from his heart, doesn't he, Brad Peary? That's what I like about him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's always been really, really, really bubbly. I've always had a really exuberant personality. I've raced against him for a few years back in sort of super teen days, and he was always towards the sharp end in that, and he'd always look forward to his interviews at the end of the day. He was almost like a young and even more excitable Guy Martin. He would just sort of speak at 2,000 mile an hour, and always great entertainment from him. And the interesting thing about him is he's got where he's got to completely just racing him and his dad, them, and obviously a few helpers, just putting the bikes together, putting himself out on circuit. Up until this year, this is the first year he's actually raced in a team, and it hasn't been him and his dad and a few helpers and sponsors. And this is the first time he's involved in a proper team, and his first time we're properly seeing him at the Sharpie. I mean, last year he was really impressive on the considering the outfit he was on and considering the team he was in, just him and his dad. And it's interesting because it's brought him on quite a bit, because now he must understand all the everything that goes on behind the scenes, and you can respect that. And now he's in that team. It would have been a big learning curve for him, because he'll never have worked in a team like that before. But one to watch for the future, I think, Brad.
Is it a weird thing, do you think, for a rider when you come into a team like that, and instead of you having to do things yourself on the bike, you've got someone else who can do it for you, and almost accepting that you can sit back and tell them what you need and they do the work for you? That must be a bit weird when you're used to getting stuck in yourself with a spanner.
I'm the wrong person to ask for that, because both myself and my dad have always been absolutely terrible with mechanic side of stuff.
Really?
So from Super Team days, we've always sort of gotten someone else to do it, because otherwise I wouldn't have had a chance of being in the top 20, because we were absolutely useless. So we've always, it does unfortunately cost a little bit extra, and you have to work that a little bit harder to find the sponsorship to get. But it does also take a lot of time off your hands, because you're not organizing as many things, so you can use that time to look for more money and look for more sponsors and use that to fund your ride. So I've always gone about it from a different perspective, just from the pure fact that I'm not capable of doing what the Curies did.
Okay, well, while we're talking about you then, let's go on to one of the classes that you've raced in before. Let's see what happens. You have to think that's Kennedy's to win again, of course, this weekend, but let's see what Ben Curry can do. Let's move on to British Junior Supersport. Okay, so again, it's a two-horse race, Tristan, and really for Ash Barnes, who on the Yamaha has now moved up to second place, he needs to pretty much win two races with Cam Dawson not scoring, because it's a 43-point lead for Cameron Dawson. He has been, in my opinion, head and shoulders above the rest. You and I have both commentated on some of the races this year. He's had seven wins. Okay, he's had a couple of non-finishes at the last two rounds at Alton and Donington. But you have to feel, if Cam Dawson on that Kawasaki didn't win it this year, that's very unlucky, because racecraft wise he has been the best, hasn't he? Let's be honest.
Yeah, he's the only rider to pick up multiple wins this season. One of the other riders, I think Luke Rowland's has had three, but he's the only one to sort of get over five. He's had seven, everyone else has had about one. Luke Rowland's had three. He's been so consistent, and so consistently better than everyone else. There hasn't really been anyone, to be honest, that can challenge him for pace outright consistently anyway. It reminds me a bit of Elliot Pinson when he won it. He was just sort of set down a pace that no one could stick with. And the thing you get a lot in junior supersport as well is if you've got Dawson with a slight advantage who's pulling away, the riders behind don't do each other favours, because they will just battle it out with each other, and they will be losing more time, and it will let Dawson get away even further. And that's what you always see in junior supersport. Yeah. Partly because that young instinct to want to just keep battling and going for it. Also because of the nature of the category with the slipstreaming and stuff like that. But so they're very early in their careers as well. So there isn't, I mean, the one thing I noticed in junior supersport a lot when I moved from the World Supersport 300 down to the junior supersport, so the BSB version essentially, was the difference in racecraft. There isn't quite, at that point in their careers, there isn't a massive sort of, but there isn't much racecraft at all, to be honest. It completely goes out the window.
Some crazy moves at times, aren't there? I mean, it's fun to commentate on, but I am there sometimes thinking, why? I mean, you tell me, because you've been in that situation, but you were one of the more sensible guys. I remember people dive bombing up the side at the inside of you on the last lap, naming no names, and you both had a chance to win that race at that point. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And it took the chance away from both of you, and I thought, well, that was a bit silly, but it's easy for me to think that and say that. Yeah. Why don't they think it through? Is it because they are young and inexperienced, or what?
They're using this time that you're using in, let's say junior supersport or British Talent Cup, whatever it may be, this time that you're using in your career is times that you're using to learn from your mistakes. So you're seeing them all making the mistakes that they're going to be learning from in the future. Whereas, you know, when they move up, graduate to whatever it's going to be next, junior superstar, supersport, whatever there is in the future, they've got more experience and more of a wise head for the future, because they've already made all those mistakes and learnt from it, which is why you see that. Also, and you know, also it's the type of racing as well. It gets very hot and you tend to sort of lose track of what's going on because everything's happening so quickly. You've got someone trying to pass you, you're trying to pass someone else, there's a big group, you're five abreast down the back straight, down the front straight, and it's just sort of turns into I need to just barge everyone out the way.
Yeah.
And then sometimes it just goes a little bit over the top because naturally you're trying to go about your race and then there's so much going on that you just need to keep reacting to it, and then you know, mistakes happen.
But that's where someone like a Cam Dawson does stand out, because he doesn't really do that, does he? He's been sensible. Like you said, we've had it in the past. Una McGlinchey won it, didn't he? And he stood out for me like that as well. He didn't do those silly things, which I guess has to be a good thing for that guy, because it makes you stand out in comparison with everyone else, doesn't it?
Yeah, but in order to do that, you need to have a slight edge pace-wise.
Right.
Because if you're stuck in that group
and
you've got a little bit of a mature head, it actually can sort of hinder you in a way, because you're sort of trying to plan your race out and trying to think things methodically, where at the same time, the riders around you aren't doing that. And it's just complete maniac racing.
Yeah.
And then your strategy or your thinking has gone completely wasted and you've ended up at the back of the group.
Okay, well, let's jump up. Let's go across now, because we're not doing this in any particular order, are we? To the World Superbike paddock and talk about the equivalent there, which is, of course, World Supersport 300. Right, before we get into the 300 class itself, I'm just going to quickly touch, Tris, on the new Blue Crew R3 Cup. Iker Garcia Abella won it this year. Julian Giraud was second, only 4 points behind. Fenton Sebright, our very own Fenton Sebright, who was the 2017 KTM RC Cup champion, finished third. He only missed it by 11 points. Went into the last round in Barcelona with a chance. He won more races than anyone else, Fenton, with five. In what has been... four races this year in what has been a very difficult year for the Sebright family, with some big losses, and it's been an incredible year, I think, from Frenton. But of course, that cup class, they can start from 12 years of age, can't they? Which is quite scary in some ways.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in you know, Spain and Italy, we see them start young, and that's how they get to MotoGP at the age that Marquez did, or the age that, you know, whoever, Mir or whatever. And yeah, that does need to translate here, but also, you know, you've got to be a little bit careful with it as well. It is quite a young age, like you say, but that's sort of the way racing has gone lately.
Now, as a rider yourself, and you've raced in World Supersport 300 and Junior Supersport, very touchy subject, of course, this at the moment, but we can't ignore it, the safety aspect. The fact is, we've lost three young riders this year in three horrendous accidents. One of them was Moto3. They've all happened in the junior categories as well, haven't they? One of them was Moto3. And of course, that was Jason DePasquier, the Swiss rider, 19 years of age. Then we had a European Talent Cup accident at Motoland Aragon for Hugo Milan, 14 years of age. And most recently, 15-year-old Dean Bertavignales at Jerez in Spain. In all three of these accidents, they've all been young kids, teenagers. And they've all been a rider getting involved in an incident, crashing, and then being run over. Awful situation, and we need to be careful how we tread here, don't we? But I think the first thing is, without sounding callous, these accidents could have happened anywhere, couldn't they? In the sense that someone's crashed and then they've either been trying to get off the track and been hit, or they've been down and been hit.
It is something that's always going to be there, but it is something we can try and sort of regulate and try and minimize. And I think in these junior categories, especially at the moment, the grids are massive, which is brilliant. It's brilliant to see loads of new prospects and hot talents coming through in these big grids. Because if you look at some of the grids a few years ago, especially what the Junior World Championship used to be, back when it was just sort of the Spanish Championship, the grid was half of what it is now. And these grids are huge now. We had in World Supersport 370 riders, and they had to split the races up. And when there's so many bikes on circuit and so with such little power, they're all trying to slipstream each other. It's a lot easier to get hit by something. And it is sort of the nature of the racing in the class. So it's really difficult one to control. But like we saw the other week in Moto3, or last weekend in America in Moto3 with that massive crash.
Yeah, that was frightening.
Really, really scary. And it's something that, this sort of tactic of slipstreaming and weaving to try and get out of the slipstream, or to sort of push someone over to force them to roll off a little bit, is something that happens, and it is something that comes along with this type of racing. But I think it's something that needs to be monitored, because we saw Dennis Onshu who made that move and came across on it was Alcobra, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's something that it wasn't a massive. He did. If you watch it, he didn't come across him massively. It wasn't a big weave or anything.
No, it wasn't like I'm deliberately going to move across and wipe you out. That definitely wasn't the case, was it?
No, but he knew he was there. You definitely know. You're aware that you're coming across someone at a certain speed, and you know that their rear wheel, their front wheel, is going to be there or thereabouts. And when I'm doing that, I'm sort of when every rider is doing that, you're sort of thinking about your peripheral, and you're thinking there's going to be someone more or less there. I'm going to sort of try and assert my dominance, but you're not going to just come across the front of someone. Do you know what I mean? Cause it also could end your race as well. Cause you might end up crashing out as well.
Yeah.
It is something that needs to be monitored, and I'm sort of, it was a mistake from Onshu. Obviously he didn't mean to do it. It's not something that you do on purpose, but I'm glad in a way that he's received a ban from the next two Grand Prix. Nothing against him, just for the pure fact that these things need to be punished, so that you do think twice about weaving or on down a back straight. You see it at Aragon in the 300s, you see it in the Moto 3 as well. You'll see the whole train coming down,
the
and
snake.
Then they all move to one side, they all move to the other side. For me, that needs to stop.
It's a very, very difficult one here, and we need to be careful what we say. Although I will say this, and I don't want to sound like Mr. Hindsight, but all year long, James Whittam and I have been saying in a podcast, there's going to be a bad accident here if we're not careful. And in a way, it's disappointing that this two-race ban for Dennis Onshu's only happened now. Because I could be wrong, Tris, but in the back of my mind, I kind of feel that had we not had the awful tragedy that we did have in Jerez, I don't know whether he would have received a two-race ban. I could be wrong. But it's just a shame in some ways that they didn't start clamping down on this before that tragedy happened. It was almost as though it was going to take a tragedy to happen. And again, I'm not just saying this now, you know, we've said it, it's on record on the podcast earlier in the year. Then again, now it's happened, it has happened, we can't go back, unfortunately. What do they do, though, about this? How does this look from the sports point of view, from the outside, when you've got the Sun, the Daily Mail, Sky News, and all these various other outlets reporting that a 14-year-old or 15-year-old child has died? For the general image of the sport, that doesn't look great, does it? And I wonder how they're going to tackle this moving forward. Are they going to increase the minimum ages? Do you think they should? I mean, does it really make much of a difference if they're starting at 18 instead of 12 or 13? The problem is, of course, all these talent cups, they'd be rendered sort of useless, wouldn't they then? And I just don't know from a commercial point of view whether they would change that now.
Well, I think riders and in all forms of motorsport, people have started young. That's always been the case. That's not something that's new.
That's true. That's true.
To be honest, just now we have more of a platform to be able to watch it and be able to see it. But we've always started. I mean, they start in the mini bike championships from as young as 5 or 6 years old on mini motos. So they're always going to find something that they can do at that age. I don't really think we can do much. I think in sport in general, you start young and you retire young for a retirement sort of. It's just the way it is, because, you know, it's the way that obviously, you know, you need to be there at the prime, the prime age where you sort of your body is at its fittest. And and that's just the way sport is. So I think from that perspective, there's not much really. I think we just need to make sure the racing for these riders is safer. Perhaps I can't remember who it was saying something about perhaps, you know, if you make these bikes faster, then you don't have that slipstreaming sort of racing. But then if you're making bikes faster for 12-year-olds and giving them more power when they're only, you know, so young, can they control that much power? So there's an argument to be made there. I would hate to be at the moment someone who has to look at these things and the the pioneers of the sport, because it's a really difficult decision to make, because you have to balance keeping the sport what it is. Because if you can go completely one way and just clamp down on absolutely everything and be extremely strict with passing and with absolutely everything, and then essentially ruin the sport, because that is a danger that there can be. I mean, we've seen a few incidents over the years that everyone's thought is slightly over the top, mainly track limits and stuff like that. But it goes in general, in all sort of rules in general, if you're massively clamping down, it's not, that's not the sport anymore. But at the same time, You know, perhaps it might have taken us, you know, three young deaths this year to realize that things do need to change in that respect as well. And I think it's just small things, just like that, like the weaving and the slipstream. And the other day in Portimao, when they red flagged the session because all the riders were cruising on the racing line, and there's a lot of bikes out on circuit, and if there's even just one going slower than race pace, it can cause an incident. I had it myself earlier in the year where there were 60 bikes on circuit at Donington. There was constant traffic, and I ended up, someone cruising on the racing line, I ended up in the back of them, I ended up breaking my leg. And the meeting before that, someone was cruising on the racing line, I ended up with concussion. It's something that needs to be thought about.
Yeah, and like you say, at the end of the day, and this does sound a bit callous, but it's an extremely dangerous sport, isn't it? Motor racing and motorcycle racing in particular, it always has been, always will be. I also would add that I think it has just also been the most terrible of coincidences that we've had so many bad accidents in one year. The Brad Jones crash at Brands Hatch, the a marshal being killed at Brands Hatch in that car racing incident a week or so after that. Young Cedric Bloch was hurt at Snetterton, and there's a GoFundMe page up after he suffered life-changing injuries. And of course, the three losses we've already said. You also can't help thinking in some ways it's the most horrendous of coincidences, because nothing really significantly has changed. It's not like we have new tyres or many more bikes, or the circuits are different, or the bikes, or the rules have changed. So in some ways, it just seems like it's been a really horrendous run for one reason or another.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a terrible year, hasn't it? We also had Brad Jones with his massive incident earlier in the year as well. Luckily, he's going through recovery quite well at the moment, which is brilliant to see.
Alessandro Valente in Junior Supersport had a really nasty accident at Donington.
Yeah, which was something that you can never, with that sort of crash, that was he'd stalled or was out of gear, something for one reason or another, he couldn't get away off of the line, off of the grid. Pretty much the whole field had gone past him, and unfortunately he got collected. A rider that unsighted didn't see him, went straight into the back. It was Chloe Jones, I believe it was, straight into the back of him.
It was Chloe,
I saw it from the outside. I was in one of the in the media centre at Donington Park. I saw it out the window live happening. It was a horrible incident. But that is something, unfortunately, that happens every now and then that we can't actually really do much about, because it's not the norm. And there's always going to be those bikes on the grid. Every now and then, one of the bikes stalls or there's an issue or something. And unfortunately, that happens.
Well, Supersport, Valentin De Bies accidentally switched his bike off on the line at Magny-Cours at the start of a warm-up lap. And the last guy to pass him was Vincent Falcone, another Frenchman. And De Bies went to move and he dodged him at the same time. And they banged helmets. It was horrible. It was an absolute miracle we didn't have a worse outcome there. But these things, sadly, can happen.
Yeah, and it's always that last rider or one of the last riders that hits because they're unsighted and they're looking forward. And it's always that one of the last, and they're always the ones that come quick because they've come from further back and they've built up more speed. Those are always horrible incidents to see.
Yeah, they are, because there's no, if someone's dead still and then they get hit, that's almost like walking out into the middle of a motorway, isn't it? It's pretty horrendous. Yeah,
it's no one's fault as well. No. It's not that makes a difference, but it's not nice to see.
Well, in the 300 class itself, and obviously we bear in mind these guys we've lost because it's been a dreadful year, and let's just hope we have a safe end to the season now. But I wouldn't be surprised if there are some kind of change for next year. I don't know what it might be. You could reduce the field. The problem is, though, you could have somebody getting run over with even two or three bikes on the track, couldn't you? That's the thing. Although I would just say, I suppose, let's be honest, there is more chance of being here if there's more riders in a group. That's the problem you got there, isn't it? But Adrian Huertas has dominated the Supersport 300 series this year. 66 points on paper. It was closer than that in reality, but Tom Booth-Amos got hurt and had to miss a few races. Huertas, he can be so aggressive when he needs to be, but I think the best man probably did win in the end. His racecraft seemed to be head and shoulders above, not head and shoulders above Tom Booth-Amos, because I don't think that's fair on Tom, because Tom had a really good year this year. But Huertas just seemed to have that extra aggression. And I'm not saying that's right, because I think some of his moves have been too hard. You know, he's moved across on TBA, for example, at Magny-Cours. That was unacceptable, in my opinion, and probably was warranting a penalty. And Tom Booth-Amos has been extremely unlucky, getting wiped out a couple of times. But Huertas is good, isn't he? And he does think his race is through. You could see him going on to do great things, actually.
Yeah, he's looked really strong this year. But personally, I was sort of gutted for Tom Booth Amos because I think he's put in a brilliant year and has had some real bad luck this year as well.
Very.
I think it has to be said.
Yeah, very.
But I mean, it bodes well for next year. I'm not sure if he's made any announcements for next year, but I would assume that he's probably going to stay in SuperSport 300 again.
I don't know. I mean, I think he wants to get up onto a 600, and there was a rumor about Orellac Kawasaki or some sort of Kawasaki 600 ride. So that would be good for Tom if he can get
there.
Yeah.
Yeah, in BSB, he's running.
Yes.
Junior Superstock, which was then Superstock 600, and I'm pretty sure possibly Supersport as well, but definitely Superstock. So he's ridden 600s before. But we were talking a little bit off air, Greg, that this jump from 300s to 600s can be such a big jump. It's not as seamless as we see the Moto3 riders jumping to Moto2. This from the Supersport 300 Championship to the World Supersport on the 600cc machines, it's a really difficult jump. And yeah. Manuel Gonzalez is probably one of the best ones that has made the jump, and Luca Bernardi as well.
Yeah.
But those guys have spent a full winters, full seasons of training non-stop on these 600 machines, riding them on karting circuits to try and get used to them. It's a transition that takes so much work.
Unai Aradre's done a decent job as well because he was racing a 600 in the Spanish Championship this year. But yeah, for sure, the standout performers are obviously Bernardi and even more so Manu Gonzalez. Yeah.
But they have to do that. They have to run that little bit of time on a 600 whilst they're running the 300 to be able to move up, which isn't something you really see in the GP paddock when they move from Moto3 to Moto2.
True. And also another thing, going into the MotoGP paddock, they've already done a full season, at least one, in the CEV Moto3 Junior World Championship on more advanced Moto3 bikes than in the World Championship, because they use that as a testing bed, don't they? And the regulations aren't so stringent, so they already know the bike like the back of their hand. No wonder they're already on the pace as soon as they get to Qatar in Moto3.
It's a formula that works, isn't it?
It is. What about Jeffrey Bowes? He's actually racing this weekend with Pichetti in World Supersport in Argentina. I hope he goes well. I really do. We need him to go well for the good of the system. I mean, we know the system's working already with the guys we just mentioned, but that's great that Jeffrey's got a ride, because there is no automatic promotion. You can tell us, Tris, how difficult is it to fund a ride and find sponsors? And this is a bit of an issue at the moment, isn't it? Because there's so many good riders who disappear off the face of the earth, not because they didn't have the talent, but because they didn't have the money, quite frankly. And it doesn't seem right. But in some ways, it's kind of always been like that, really.
You say that, but I think over the past 10 years, I was speaking to Gino Rea, who used to race in Supersport.
Yeah.
And he was saying, from the time he started in Supersport to the time he left, it changed completely. So ever since the sort of the credit crunch sort of time, everything, you know, bonuses started going down. There was less money and involvement from manufacturers.
Now bear in mind as well, Gino's done European Superstock 600 where he won it, and he's done the Moto3 World Championship and very nearly won a Grand Prix, I remember, in the rain in Malaysia. So that's interesting there.
Yeah, and even Fabrizio and Malandri both said when they came back to the paddock that it's completely not the paddock they remember at all, and the situation is completely different, where pretty much every rider in sort of, definitely in Supersport 300, most of the 99% of the field, and in World Supersport as well, they're paying a lot of money to be there. And for World Supersport, you're looking at around from 100 to 250,000 euros. When I was in Supersport 300, it was about 65,000 euros for the year. That's just for the team, without your accommodation expenses, without your traveling expenses, without anything like that. It's about 65,000 euros back then. And I think I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's got more expensive. I've heard that figures of around 90,000 even for Supersport 300.
Crazy money, isn't it? Let's just bring ourselves back to earth for a second, because we're banding these numbers around. That's ridiculous, isn't it, when you think about it? Anyone who's got a normal job, and then you put that into perspective, that's crazy. And what about the Moto3 Junior World Championship? Emilio Altamora's team, Monlau, Estrella Galicia, I've heard even like 400,000 euros from Moto3 Junior World Championship ride.
Yeah.
Now, surely someone's got to stop here and say, what the hell is going on? Because that's ridiculous.
I won't say the team, but I was offered a ride in Junior World Championship for like a wildcard ride for the last three rounds, I believe it was. So just three races of the season.
Yeah, and in the Moto3 Junior World Championship.
Junior World Championship with a decently established team. And they were asking for 70,000 euros just for three races.
That's just incredible, isn't it?
Which is, you know, triple or more the average salary in the UK.
Now, this is 70,000 euros for you to go out there and risk your life, by the way. Let's not forget that. And by the way, this isn't me shooting down motorcycle racing, because I work in the industry myself and I love it and it's my life and I live and breathe it. But it just... James Tozend and I were chatting about this on the podcast last week, and he said something's wrong here at grassroots level, and it probably goes back to the tobacco sponsorship ban in 2006. Because our sport lived on tobacco, didn't it? You had Camel, you had West, you had Marlboro were involved very much in F1 with Ferrari and all the other tobacco companies, British American Tobacco, the whole of the rest of them. It's been replaced in some ways by energy drinks, but it's nowhere near the same, is it? You know, I've heard stories, Tris, of when colleagues used to do press releases in MotoGP and there'd be a massive tobacco company backing the team and they'd have such a huge budget, they'd be paying people thousands of euros just to do a press release or two over a weekend because they had that budget to allocate. So they either allocate the budget to someone or it gets removed for the next year. So whoever the middleman was, oh, we better use it on something. That, and it was a bit of a false economy, I suppose. The bubble did burst, didn't it? And then obviously we had the global credit crunch in 2008 as well. Where do we go from here then? I mean, how is there any way of solving this? I guess the only way to solve it, and this is very easy for me to say, would be the FIM to get together with the various organisers of the various championships and put some system in place. But where's the money going to come from? It's got to come from somewhere, hasn't it?
One thing we do need to keep in mind is Dorna is doing a lot for the sport, and they're trying to put a lot together with these talent cups, especially. I mean, if you just look at the Honda British Talent Cup, the amount of money they spent, especially on the first couple of seasons, getting all the kit in place, putting everything in place. It's the only championship in the UK at the moment for any young riders with prize money, fairly considerable prize money,
true.
And prizes at the end of it.
And they get tyres handed out to them as well, don't they?
They get tires, and that's all sort of... MSVR is also helping out on that, which is good to see. But with that Dorna involvement and that Dorna, really pushing it, I think we do need to be grateful for that, because it's also not their job to do that. It's we need to be, I can only talk from a side of the British racing scene, because I'm not 100% sure what it's like out in you see things and you hear rumors, but I can only talk from my perspective, and we can. We need to be grateful for them, because they put a lot in for us, when ideally we need to be doing that for ourselves, not waiting for Dorna or the Spanish to do it for us.
Dorna did that with the academy as well, the Movistar Academy they had 20 years ago, 2001, two people like Casey Stoner, Danny Pedrosa came up through there. And I mean, also you've got to remember the work Dorna and MSV and all the other series organizers are doing to get this show on the road at the moment, because it's been a total nightmare. I was chatting with Gregory Lavia the other day about the World Superbike situation, and you can't even imagine how difficult it's been, the things they've had to juggle and get through to. It's been crazy with this COVID scenario and travel restrictions, and can you imagine? I mean, it's bad enough trying to organize a holiday or something, which I haven't even done anyway, because I wouldn't even want, that's too much of an issue anyway. Imagine trying to organize a circus, as this effectively is, to go around the world, flights and hotel. It must be a nightmare, mustn't it?
The amount of equipment they get shipped across is an incredible amount, and you don't realize until you go to the rounds and you see all the same stuff at every single round at every
as though it's by magic. Some people get used to that, don't they? They don't think it's all been in massive traveling cases and on massive jumbo jets, and the tires, for example, for Indonesia. Pirelli were telling me the other day, they were sent out there in August for a race that's happening in the middle of November. And the Phillip Island tires, normally for the end of February in a normal year, they're sent out the November before. That's how far ahead they have to think. It's incredible.
Madness.
Absolutely amazing. Okay, well, let's move on, because we've got, I don't know how long we got left here. We've got about 20 minutes left. So we've got quite a few categories still to get through here. Supersport 300 and the R3 Cup are done. I can cross them off my list. Let's go back to BSB and rattle off a few of the junior categories there. Okay. Let's just cover off, first of all, the Ducati Tri-Options Cup, because that's already been won. So with respect to those guys, we won't dedicate quite so much time to that in this podcast today. But it's been a tremendous season, having just passed the 10-year cutoff for the Tri-Options Cup. They're into their 11th season, I think it is now. John McGuinness, Chris Walker, they've really brought the series to the fore this year. David Shoebridge, Craig Neave, people like that. Some great, quick, really good riders there. And there's a mix of gentleman racers and some really young superstars. But it's Josh Day who's won it for the third time. And I think he's going to be in British Supersport next year with one of the new V2 Ducatis, I understand. So watch out for that. National Superstock, Trish. We talked about Super Sport before, but what about National Superstock? First of all, I think we need to talk about Taylor McKenzie and his retirement, because that was a very emotional retirement, wasn't it? Back at Donington the other day. He'll be retiring at the end of the year. I don't know whether he's going to focus on his YouTube blogging, or I know he likes a bit of TV commentary. He's done some stuff with us at Eurosport on World Endurance. He'll no doubt be supporting Taz, who may well be in World Superbikes next year. But that must have been a tough decision for Taylor to have to make that.
Yeah, it is a tough decision. It'd be a tough decision for anyone to make, especially when, I mean, he will have grown up around bike racing. He probably will have started from a young age with Neil pushing him on. It's been a massive part of his life. All he's known for the past however many years, 10 to 20 years, however long he's been doing it.
And, yeah, his whole life, basically, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it is a massive decision, and it's something I'm sure he will have been thinking about for a while. Although it might seem like it's come out of the blue, it definitely won't have done. And even at the beginning of the season, it looked like he wasn't even going to ride this season. So it's definitely something he had in the back of his mind. And to go out with a bang, 31st to 1st, obviously he's got another weekend to pick up some more results. But to go out on a high is how you want to end it. And it's not... He won't look at it as an end, just a change of chapter. So he'll, you know, possibly be looking down other ventures. We've seen him doing stuff on YouTube and with Eurosport as well. So that's possibly he'll still be around the paddock. That's for sure. I mean, you know, Neil hasn't managed to leave the paddock. And how long has he been supposedly retired for? It's not really something that he's always going to be around. It's always going to be a part of his life, no matter whether he's retired or not.
And in terms of that championship, Tom Neave, Binny McConnell, Alex Olsen, 23 points covering the trio. I mean, it's Tom Neave's to lose, because the others basically need to win that last race. Well, they do have to win the last race with those gaps. They've got to win it with Tom Neave not scoring. But anything can happen at Brands Hatch in the middle of October, can't it?
Yeah, it can. Absolutely. And there's a lot of riders that are going to be very hungry for results at that last round as well. I know the Aprilia boys with Fraser Rogers on, they're going to be hungry for another victory. They've only had one this year. And we know that Aprilia is a capable bike in that category. It's looked really strong with the last couple of rides, seasons. They're going to be looking strong. If it's wet, we can expect to see Lewis Rollo at the sharp end again. Lewis Rollo's worth mentioning as well, because he's was third in the championship last year and has struggled this year with chatter pretty much all year on that Kawasaki. Moving from the Aprilia to the Kawasaki just shows you. I mean, Morello is an incredible rider, and he's had some big issues this year, but it does also just show how good that Aprilia is.
So British sidecars, let's just quickly touch on that, because that's already been decided this year as well in the favour of Ben and Tom Burchill. They've got a 109-point advantage going into Brands Hatch. Now, were you not commentating on the last race with that really weird incident at Donington when they actually went off on the warm-up lap, didn't they?
Yeah, I was commentating for the second race, and yeah, there was that big crash. Through Starkey's on the warm-up lap, there was a massive crash, which isn't something you used to see, and not the way that they will have wanted to.
Oh, so there was a crash through Starkey's, because the one I saw was at Goddard's at the end of the lap, and the Burchills went off down into Goddard's. Was there another one that I've not seen there?
That might have been race one, race two.
Oh, I see.
There was another one on a warm-up.
Oh, really? Because I just watched the highlights back. I've not watched the full races yet. Oh, crikey! Okay.
Yeah, I missed race one, so I missed that one, but I saw the big moment at Starkey's on the warm-up lap.
So what happened at Starkey's? Was that like...
It was just... It was almost looked like a lack of concentration. It was just a bit of a... They got a bit of a slide on and ended up on one side of the grass and then the other side. And the outfit wasn't in a very good way either.
Oh, what a mess. The Burchills did go on to win that race then, we can confirm, with Blackstock and Rosny were second after their win in the first race. Lewis Blackstock and Paddy Rosny. John Holden got third in the first race. I'm just seeing who got third in the second one. Oh, it was Robinson and Fairhurst. So there was obviously a very dramatic race there. I like the sidecar race. They get a lot of stick, don't they? But since I've been in the BSB paddock since 2017 and got to know Barry Nutley, I know a lot of people dish the sidecars, I say, oh, they drop oil everywhere and all the rest of it. But they're good fun, aren't they? And it's more than just a sidecar driver and a passenger. It's a co-driver. Without the co-driver there, the passenger there, that thing wouldn't turn. I mean, it's so different to anything else. That's what I like about it. It's like a cross between bike and car racing. It's chaos sometimes, though. And it must take some real doing to be a passenger. Can you imagine doing that?
Yeah, it's really, you don't realize how tiring it is until you have a go on it. I've never actually had to go on one of the big ones, but I've had to go on one of the smaller ones, sort of 85cc things, two-stroke things, on a karting circuit. And I just got sort of put on it. No one told me how to do it or what the techniques are or anything like that. They just said, oh, just jump on this sidecar and have a go. And I was just genuinely screaming for a good five laps because it's a lot more physical and it's a lot... it's a lot more than you realize. It is hard work, and I can only imagine what it must be like on those. They're 600cc engines, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They're super sport engines.
So good 130 to 150 brake. I can only imagine how much, what the forces must be like on one of those things.
Crazy, isn't it? Okay, let's move on to some more of the support categories, and then we've got to get on to World Superbike because we're running out of time. But the British Talent Cup, first of all, some exciting news there. While we've been recording, you've just been checking online. Casey O'Gorman has won that championship despite missing several races. I mean, he had five races with no points at all, not Kyle Brands GP in Thruxton, and ends up winning it. Of course, he's backed by Eurosport's very own Shaky Byrne and Matt Roberts. Incredible talent this season. Carter Brown missing out by 6 points. Evan Belford third, 29 behind. But Tris, some exciting news for Casey while we've been recording this show.
Yeah, it's been an incredible season for Casey. Like we say, came back from that massive injury that he had at BB, picked up at Knockhill, which forced him to miss five races. And he came back from a 91-point deficit that he had to Evan, came back across 91 points, 60 that he had to Carter Brown as well.
Wow.
So, yeah, he came back from a long, long way and ended up winning it right at the end. Was leading the championship by 1 point going into the final round, and then topped every session that weekend, got the lap record and won both races. So it was a perfect, and won the championship. So it was a perfect weekend for him. And now it's been announced that he has been selected for the Red Bull Rookies next year. So it'll be interesting to see what he does. I'm pretty sure he's doing the last final round of the European Talent Cup at Valencia later on in the year as well. So we'll keep an eye out for him on that. So yeah, definitely a star of the future, Casey, an immense, immense talent. And has come on really well this year. I think you can say last year his downfall was he was crashing a little bit too much, but this year he's had a really calm head, possibly with the influence that he's had from Shaky Byrne and Matt Roberts, like you say, and he's been a much calmer rider this year. Unfortunately, that crash that he had with that big injury was no fault of his own, and was really unfortunate, but he came back and won it. And I would say that the right rider deserved to win. There was also some riders that, you know, really, really strong in that category. Evan Belford was looking really good all year. Had a bit of a weird sort of dry spell halfway through the year and then recovered towards the end. Carter Brown was always really entertaining when Carter Brown was in the mix. I think there's riders to be looking forward to watching next year as well that are going to be looking to pick up the championship. And I think riders like Ollie Walker and Johnny Garness as well, he's really looking towards next year. And those are the guys who I think are going to be battling it out for it. There's a couple of other names in there that are going to be battling out for it next year as well. So all stars of the future, and hopefully with enough help from Dorna and stuff, we'll see them progressing forward.
Yeah, Cormac Buchanan, of course, one to watch out for as well, the rider from New Zealand who's raced to some great success actually over in New Zealand, hasn't he, before? And he's been in the Red Bull Rookies this year as well, but not done all the Talent Cup races, which is why he's dropped back to 11th overall in the end. But he would have been much higher up than that had he done all the races. What's been interesting this year, and you've commentated on a lot of the races, I've commentated on a lot of the races alongside Neil McKenzie, is that we've seen some of those light riders, Johnny Garness and Sullivan Mounsey, Keanu Vaya, people like that, absolutely flying off the line and often getting to the front, don't we?
Yeah.
And really frustrating the guys behind. But of course, the older they get and the larger they get, they're going to lose that advantage. Whereas others like Carter Brown, Belford, O'Gorman, they're really honing on their racecraft, aren't they? And that seems to be the really important key there, racecraft.
Yeah. I mean, it's good in racing to be able to know your advantages and to be able to use them to your advantage and to use them to win races and more like blitz to the front off of the line and stuff like that. So that's good for them to be learning, because there might be a situation later down the line where, you know, like we're seeing at the moment at World Superbike, where a big disparity in straight line speed and one's faster than the other, and they can use that to their advantage and perhaps not take as many risks throughout a certain set of corners, because they know that they can just blast past down the straight, and then that's in your head. So they're all learning at the same rate. They're all learning different things as well, which is always interesting. And I think that, you know, there's quite a few different teams in that category as well. So there's plenty of different areas that they're learning from. But yeah, like you say, the likes of Carter Brown and Lucas Brown's another one of the tall ones as well, who will probably be looking for a bit of a better season next year. They've really, you can see them come into their own throughout some of the faster corners and during the wet, when that little bit of extra weight helps them out. So they're both, I think both sides of it, there's an argument on both sides whether they're both learning to use their advantages or their strengths to their best advantage. So it's two different ways of going about racing, and neither of them can really control the reason why, because it's just completely down to the height.
Just quickly, because we're running out of time, we'll have to get onto the superbikes in a minute, but we can't end this podcast without talking about junior super stock. We've spoken about junior super sport, but junior super stock, now we've worked on this quite closely, haven't we, across the season. Some incredible races. I mean, I'll never forget the opening round at Alton Park. And the way, for me, that typified the season in many ways. Zach Cordroy was incredible to watch, I thought, all year long, because you never knew which way he was going to go and what was going to happen. But Jack Nixon, in that first round at Alton Park, was picking them off. Remember the second race there? The first one, they ran wide at Lodge, didn't they? And he took 2 for 1 and won the race. But then he did the double. And the way he won that second one at Alton, he picked them off from about fifth place. And you could see him coming fourth, third, second, first, and he did it again a few other times across the season, and he won in the end. He's not won it yet. He's 13 points ahead of Joe Talbot going into the final round to have the advantage going into the last round. But they've fallen out, haven't they? They had a bit of a coming together at Alton Park once or twice, so they're not on speaking terms, I understand. You were telling me off air the other day, and I'm not surprised, because there were some dramatic lunges at Alton. But what an incredible situation going into that last round at Brands. And that's been a really exciting category this year.
Yeah, that's been really exciting. That was big. It was a big moment between Nixon and Talbot, the two championship contenders back at Alton.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure there was a little bit of needle there. I'm
I have
sure
to say that one looked like Jack's fault to me. I think Jack Nixon's been fantastic, and he has been the best rider, I think, this year. But that one, that was a bit of a late lunge, I think even Jack would admit. I'm not surprised Talbot was annoyed at that one.
Yeah, I mean, it's a type of racing that really lends itself to that, isn't it? Because we've seen that from many, many riders. Eugene McManus has done a couple of those, and Zach Cordroy is not shy of a few ambitious moves. Like we've said in the commentary box a few times, he's always one to look out for. And I think the rider I feel for the most is at the moment is George Stanley, because he's just been so close to getting that victory. It's just never quite happened for him. He totally deserves it. He's only got one more chance, well, two chances at Brands.
I mean, Donington was his closest chance, wasn't it, really, when he high-sided in front of Nixon coming out of the chicane. I couldn't believe that was such a dramatic few seconds in that race, wasn't it? Because we had Cade Favet and Cordroy going down at McLean's, didn't we, in the contact that never was. They didn't actually touch, I don't think, did they? And then just seconds later, George Stanley high-sided coming out of the chicane. I mean, we didn't know which way to look next, did we, in that one?
No, it was one of those sort of moments where you're still sort of watching the replay from one race, and then all of a sudden the camera changes and you're looking at someone else in a gravel trap and trying to figure out what happened there.
Yeah.
And it all happened all at once.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And then do you remember Silverstone? Do you remember the carnage at Silverstone? We had like 7 all trackside after they all went down at Maggots.
Yeah, it was just a case of Carver director just constantly switching from different riders in gravel traps, and we were trying to quickly call who it was
and count and successfully count how many there were, I seem to remember.
Yeah,
it's been a great category this year. Just quickly, from a riding point of view, because you were racing in that category at the start of the year. Once you get to that point, Trish, you've come up through the order, like Fab Racing or Bemzy, Thundersport, Club Racing. Fab Racing is obviously the official feeder series, isn't it, to BSB? But you come up through the ranks. You maybe done a British Talent Cup, you know, Junior Super Sport, something like that. By the time you get to Junior Super Stock, You're on some pretty serious racing bikes then, aren't you? They're quick things, and that's where setup changes also have a big effect, isn't it, in comparison with some of the smaller bikes?
Yeah, when you're so used to the world of racing, you hear the phrase little 600 being thrown around quite a lot, and which in the grand scheme of things, when you've got the super bikes and stock thousands, and they are little 600s, but they are still extremely quick, extremely powerful machines for the normal person anyway. And you don't, after spending, because pretty much no one really had any track time during the off season because of COVID and various other things. And then when we got back on circuit, I completely forgot how fast they are. That's only a stock 600 as well. The Super Sport will be a little bit quicker as well.
Are the brakes very, more sensitive as well? Do you know on a superbike, how they say one of the big problems these days is not just the acceleration, but stopping the things. Yeah. What's that like in a stock 6? Is that a big difference in comparison with a junior Super Sport?
It is, yeah. In comparison between something like Junior Supersport, yes, but you're also stopping more weight and at a faster speed.
Yes.
So you don't notice. I personally didn't notice it as much. Also, because I came from the KTM as well, which had the strongest brakes on out of any of the 300s. So it sort of had a superbike brake, half a superbike brake on a 300, and it was the lightest. So the KTM stopped really well anyway. But if you're coming up from one of the Kawasaki 400s or something to a super stock 600, you would really feel the difference.
Well, just a quick reminder to those of you who are listening, first of all, if it's your first time, this is Full Throttle, Tristan Finocchiaro and Greg Haynes with you. Subscribe if you can, like the podcast. We're on all the podcast suppliers. There's no point listing them all because there's so many of them, but we're out there now, Full Throttle from Eurosport. All these races we're talking about, by the way, every single one of these support races at BSB is shown live on the Eurosport app. Sometimes you'll see it referred to as the Eurosport player, so you can get that on your tablet, your mobile device, and on your computer as well. Let's move on though, Tris, because we're into the final few minutes, and talk about World Superbike and World Supersport. So, Argentina this weekend, let's get Supersport covered first, because I'm not going to say it's all decided, because it definitely is not. Stephen Odendaal put in a great performance to take that win in Portimao a couple of weekends ago. Agata finished fifth, and it could have easily been seventh, because Nicky Tulli and Raffaele De Rosa crashed in front of him on the penultimate lap. And Odendaal, on the Evan Bros bike, has brought it back down to 54 points. Now, Agata's obviously the favourite, but it's not done yet, and it could still go. It could still go back in favour of Odendaal, who led the championship at the beginning of the year. I don't know. If you'd put money on it, who would you go for? I think I'd have to go Agata, but you never know.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think Odendaal's always been there or thereabouts and is always able to pick up the pieces. I think if I wanted to put an adventurous move on someone, I'd probably put my money on Odendaal, because I think it's possible.
Wow.
But it's not quite there yet, if you know what I mean.
They've definitely found something with that bike though, haven't they? Because they've been a bit in the wilderness with setup over the last few rounds, and all of a sudden, boom, Portimao, he was back where we expected him to be on the Sunday in particular.
I think if you were wise, you'd go for Agata. Of course, he's also had a lot of success over in Moto E this year as well. And he's missed a couple of rounds due to Moto E as well, hasn't he?
I think. Yes, he missed two races at Barcelona, two races.
So that's 50 points that he's missed out on.
Yeah.
And he's still, what is it, 54 points in the
54,
league?
Yeah.
So, he's been incredibly consistent. And it does, unfortunately, show how quick these Moto 2 boys are compared to the Supersport, because they come over. We saw Locatelli last year. Agata this year. Odendaal's also an ex-Moto 2 rider. So it tends to be the way these guys are going. We do see a lot of the Moto 2 guys coming over, but it could go anyway. But you'd probably go for Agata on that one. Obviously, also depends on how many rounds we're having, because we still don't know.
Yeah, let's hope. Let's really hope that this Mandalika thing happens. I was chatting with Dorna the other day and they were saying it's either Indonesia or nothing. There won't be a backup round now in Europe. So let's just hope travel and everything is going to be okay and that the track is going to be okay. There is an Asia Talent Cup event there the week before, which would have been the Superbike event. But I think basically what's happened is they've pushed it back
so it doesn't any longer clash with MotoGP in Valencia, but also it gives them that opportunity of using that talent cut round, doesn't it, to test out the circuit. So let's hope the Mandalika track is okay, but I think it's in everybody's interest to be in the lead of the championship if you're Agata or Odendaal or the superbike riders leaving Argentina, just in case. But it would be terrible if we had a 1993 situation when they had a round in Mexico. They got there and there was delivery vans crossing the track, dogs on the track, kids playing football, all sorts of stuff. They had to cancel it. So it had effectively been decided at the previous round. Unfortunately, we never got a finale. That would be a terrible thing if that happens again. Supersport then, find of the year in many ways, Manuel Gonzalez. He's third overall as the former Supersport 300 world champion and European Tanner Cup champion. Superbikes then. It is one of the best seasons we've ever seen, isn't it, for World Superbikes? There is no doubt about it. 54 points between Raz Gatioglu, Ray and Redding. I would not want to put money on this. I think you'd have to say Toprak very much deserves the title, doesn't he? In the sense that his non-scores have not been his fault this year. He got wiped out by Gerloff at Assen, the alternator failure at Barcelona, and then the mudguard coming off in Portimao the other day. Incredibly unlucky. Jonathan Ray's crashes have been his fault. And he's had five crashes in races this year, which is amazing. But he's been put under massive pressure, isn't he? And all those crashes he's had have been the same front-end crash when he's either trying to keep up with or pull away from Toprak. So you have to feel Toprak has the advantage. But you can never, ever, ever write off Jonathan Rea, as we've seen so many times before.
We've never seen that from him before, that many crashes. He never makes a mistake. I mean, I think something we always used to say is he'd have these big moments, almost not quite Marc Marquez-esque, but he'd always have close moments. He'd always manage to stay on the bike. He was perfect. Like he would do everything extremely well and everything to perfection, even saving big moments. But this year he's been pushed to his limit and over his limit by mainly by Toprak. Also Scott's pushed him a little bit. Rinaldi had a couple of good runs as well, but he's been pushed all around. And I think I think a lot of people are very unhappy at Kawasaki about the fact that they've lost all these revs. But at the same time, it's made for incredible racing.
Yeah.
And Toprak is thoroughly deserved to be where he is. So unlucky to have your mudguard come off, get caught under the rear, under your front wheel at the exact point you're on the side of the tire, going through one of the fastest corners on the circuit, no chance of that ever gripping, and you go straight down. So unlucky, because if that came off down the front straight, it would have just flown off. You wouldn't have known much about it, probably would have noticed it, but it wouldn't have crashed. The point at which, if let's say it was 5-10 seconds later, not even, he would have just flown off and he wouldn't have known, and he wouldn't have felt a thing.
Unbelievable.
So it was incredibly unlucky for him. I can honestly say I'm enjoying World Superbike this year more than MotoGP, which I haven't been able to say for years. And it's been really incredible this year, especially between Jonathan and that little bit of entertainment at the end where we had Toprak cleaning the side of the circuit and then Jonathan dirtying it again. I was wondering if there was a link there, if that was just a tedious link, but it was genuinely there was a comment made after the race by Jonathan as well, where he confirmed that he was dirtying the track where Toprak had cleaned it. So definitely some needle going on between those two, I think.
But we've also seen a very emotional Jonathan Rea, haven't we? He admitted himself he was in tears after the sprint race crash, and he seemed close to tears again, didn't he? He was almost in tears when he said that comment about I made the track dirty again, which we heard in the podcast last week. We've never seen, if Jonathan Rea wins it again this year, it's his best ever. And I said that in 2019 when he had to overcome the whole Bautista thing. This would be his best again. The guy, but he's been pushed to breaking point here, or certainly near breaking point. And that win he had on Sunday in Portugal was a very emotional one. You could see how much it meant to him. Because Toprak is something quite phenomenal, isn't it? What's your take as a rider yourself, having raced on the Toprak thing? I must admit, I love watching the guy. I think he's an incredible talent. He deserves to win. It would be fantastic for the sport if he wins. Whoever wins deserves to win it. I would also just say that. Mm-hmm. But did it go a little bit over the line with Portugal? Race one in particular, because he shoved Jonathan Rea very, very hard from the left-hand side. Yeah. And I must admit, I like the championship being shaken up. I like different winners. I like the fight going down to the wire. But that was a really hard bit of riding there, wasn't it? He almost intentionally meant to push Rea out of the way.
You have a better memory than me, Greg. But personally, I can't think of a time, and Superbike anyway, that Toprak has taken anyone out this year.
No, that's a very that is a very good point.
Ever taken anyone out, actually. I can't, off the top of my head. There was that incident in that Stock 600 race a long time ago.
Between him and Ronaldo. Ronaldo. I was just about to say that, but even that wasn't like an overtake. That was Toprak coming through Tosa, wasn't it? He had a moment, had to get off the throttle, and Ronaldo ran up the back of him and ended up crashing. But no, you're a very good point, actually, Tristan. I can't ever remember Toprak diving up the inside of someone. I remember Jonathan Rea diving at the inside of Alex Lowes and taking him out in Jerez.
It's been done. We've seen Jonathan do it once at least.
And I remember him lunging on Tom Sykes in Qatar, and Tom had to sit up. I mean, Jonathan is as hard as they come. Let's have no confusion here. You know, Jonathan is a hard, hard, hard racer, and he's generally been the best at everything over the last few years. Best qualifying, best starts, best pulling away in the first few laps, best overtaking when he's needed to do it. But he's met his match this year, hasn't he? There's no doubt about it. He's met his match.
Yeah. Toprak rides hard. And he said in multiple occasions that that's the way he rides, and he's not going to change that. And I respect him for that.
And he's not scared.
No, he's very entertaining on screen. Maybe sometimes it does look like it's slightly over. But like we say, we've never actually seen him take anyone out or do anything that's caused anyone any harm. Some of the moves have been very hard with Jonathan, from both sides, to be honest, though, you have to say. Although Jonathan sort of dishes it back out because he's receiving, so he can take it and he can dish it out, which is the good thing about Jonathan as well. He doesn't just sort of, I think a couple of times we see with Scott where Toprak's made a hard move on Scott, or even Jonathan's made a hard move on Scott, and you know we've seen quite a few times Scott a shake of the head on board that Ducati, and then it sort of, I think sometimes it gets to him a little bit because he's very emotional and he's very passionate, which is brilliant, and you know it's why he's very entertaining. But I think sometimes that hinders him a little bit because a hard move sort of gets in his head and then he gets a little bit frustrated, whereas Jonathan's more of a machine where if you upset Jonathan on circuit, he will just bite back straight away. It won't turn into an emotional thing where he gets frustrated and loses time. He'll just use it against you.
Yes, I think Jonathan is a very emotional man, but you're absolutely right. He can separate it better than anyone else. It's like a switch in his head, isn't it? And if and when he wins the title this year, the tears will flow. But you're absolutely right. When he's on the track, he's like, okay, well, right. If that's the way you want to play, my friend, that's the way we'll play.
Yeah.
But crikey, what a show it's been, though. It's unbelievable, isn't it? They're taking lumps out of each other. Can Redding do it then? Redding said, I need the other two to hit trouble. I mean, you're a half Italian. You would love the idea. You would surely love the idea of the thought of a red Ducati winning for the first time in 10 years. Mm-hmm. But even Scott is saying, I'm going to need other things to happen. He's got to just try and win the last six races, hasn't he? And hope the other two do take each other off or something, which is possible, actually.
Yeah. I mean, watching from the sofa, like I have done all this year, it's, you know, and watching with my family, it's very much been us supporting Scott and wanting Scott to do well because it's very, very Italian family with the and pushing on Ducati.
Can Redding do it then? I mean, you never know, do you? You never know. And then you've got what I've been calling, I hope it doesn't sound disrespectful, but the B-side riders, the B-team riders, because they are, aren't they? They're 229 points behind the leader. Rinaldi, Locatelli, Lowes. In fact, Vandermark's got between them now and up to sixth, because Alex has been injured. But that's a great fight too. And Rinaldi and Locatelli are absolutely equal still on points. They were going into Portugal. They were coming out. That's a really fascinating little scrap for me as well. Who's going to get the best of the rest position?
Yeah, that's... like you say, that's an interesting one. I mean, we've seen with those sort of positions, you've got obviously the top three that just sort of slightly above the rest. Every now and then you see another name in there. And then that, like you say, the battle for the rest has just been between anyone, isn't it? The Hondas have looked better towards the end of the season. I know you're very much backing them because you've been singing their praises for a while, and they've only just started coming good now.
Yeah, I have actually.
But I think everyone has. Everyone's been saying with that HRC involvement, they're going to be bringing things on, and we're going to see it soon. Obviously, Leon Camus, you know, got a very methodical head on him as well. And we've all been waiting for that to happen. And I think it's starting to happen now, but I think there's just a few fundamental issues. Not sure what they are, but I think there's just a few fundamental issues that they've been trying to get over.
I think the problem they've had is they've come back in 2002, you said, had unlimited testing and all the rest of it, and you haven't got that anymore. And sure enough, where have they done well? Barcelona and Jerez, they had a test before both of those races, so it's not a coincidence. And then they carry that form into Portugal. I think the COVID things hit them badly as well, because there's a lot of new parts to try and come in from Japan, which haven't been able to come over, or haven't been able to come over on time because of the whole travel chaos going on with COVID. So, yeah, it feels like they're slowly getting there now. But it's been a bit of an embarrassing season. There's no doubt about it with Honda. But, of course, they're going to have an all-new lineup probably next year. So that could shake things around again as well. But, yeah, I think the paddock are wary of Honda. But they need to get it together. They have this sort of methodical approach, don't they, where every single part has to go through a rigorous sequence of departments to be put on the bike. They can't just throw something on and try it. And that's definitely slowed them as well, because they don't want to be seen as being, you know, impetulant or unreliable in any way. So it has to go through this sequence of events. But yeah, they're getting there, aren't they? They are getting there. And I hope for the sake of the championship, they're up there next year. It would be great if Honda did win a race this year, because it would have meant that all five manufacturers had actually won races.
Yeah, and then on the flip side of the coin as well, you've got BMW that are also in a very similar position to Honda, that are throwing a lot of money at their project and trying to get their bike up the sharp end. Because I think, you know, I think it's safe to say it's not quite a Yamaha, Kawasaki or Ducati. It's probably a similar level of the Honda. And what's going to be interesting is to see how Scott develops that bike, having ridden a bike that is, you know, on paper better. Results wise, it'd be interesting to see what his involvement will be on that as well.
Yeah, okay, well, thanks for everything, Tris. We've got through all 12 categories we've all been covering this year. It's amazing how many of them there are. One final thought for you. You're going to be at Brands Hatch. I'll be commentating an Argentina World Superbikes. You'll be at Brands for BSB. What are you most looking forward to this weekend?
I've got to say Junior Superstock, because there's that battle that's going right down to the wire, and that between Nixon and Talbot. But you can't take your eyes off the big screen. You can't keep your eyes off of BSB, because that can go absolutely any way, and that's going to be extremely interesting. Because also, no idea which way the conditions are going to go. Gino Rea, we got to give a shout out to him, because he had a brilliant ride back at Donington, and he could do really well if there's in bad conditions or in good conditions. So there's a championships to be decided, so looking forward to that, and hopefully some great racing as well.
Yeah, and I think I'd have to say Jeffrey Bowes is somebody I'm keeping an eye on in World Supersport. I think it would be great if he could go to Argentina and score points. Top 10 would be really good, so fingers crossed for Jeffrey, he can do that. And then, yeah, I'm most looking forward to seeing how this amazing scrap continues between Ray, Raz Gattiolo and Redding. Everyone is on the edges of their seats at the moment. It feels like the whole world is talking about World Superbikes, and that's absolutely fantastic. We'll be live. There's no free practice this weekend, as unfortunately we don't have the satellite signal provided. They don't show live free practice anywhere for the non-European rounds at the moment, so that's out of our hands, I'm afraid. But we will be live from Brands Hatch, first of all, and then the evening, of course, for Argentina. James Tozend and I will be commentating. Same again on Sunday. Tristan will be commentating over on Junior Superstock, as he said. Are you doing anything else this coming weekend, or is it just Junior Superstock this time?
To my knowledge, at the moment, it's just Junior Superstock.
Okay, so let's see. I'll be listening out for you there, and potentially anything else you might crop up. Well, obviously, the Talent Cup's finished now, hasn't it? So that would explain that. Tris, have a really good one. Thanks for the podcast. And we will speak to you all from Brands and Argentina over the weekend. The podcast, we will be back next week.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free.
warbyparker.com/covered.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.